Everyone, good day. This is Siraj from Centuro Global, and welcome to Coffee with Centuro. I've got Ben and a different-looking Zain today. Zain, unfortunately, is either not feeling well. We've substituted him with Shukri, who's from Johannesburg. He's in Johannesburg. He's the CEO of the Fortified Group, as well as the entrepreneurial expert at Oxford Said Business School. So welcome, Shukri. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, good to be here.
Good morning.
Coffee.
Lovely. Hopefully one day we will be able to actually sit in a physical coffee shop and have the discussion. So I'm going to jump straight in, guys. A friend of mine was going to get married last year, and then she postponed it to 2020 because she liked the sound of it, 2020. It's kind of round. And she said, let's get married in 2020. She's still unmarried, and now she's going to look for another year that sounds really cool. But the year is kind of a year to forget, right? But there's some really major events that were meant to take place this year. And the first is the Olympics. And I want to throw it out to you guys and kind of see your opinion and ask you what, I mean, there's one thing about the athletes and how they've needed to readjust their training schedule, but what about the organization of the Olympics? How do you think this has shaken things up with, if you've, because let's be honest, you win an Olympic bid and then you work on it for 10 years, right?
Probably grateful for a little bit more time, I imagine, some of the construction. I don't know if I've heard of an Olympic city being built perfectly on time and ready to go without any problems, so there's probably that. And just quickly on your point of it sounding good, there's also been a lot of, not jokes, but people pointing out that the 2020 Olympic flag that they designed would have been perfect because they've obviously built the zeros from the 2020 into the rings and everything. And now, and obviously with Japan built the well, and they're like the most perfect flag there will ever be. And the Olympics aren't going ahead in this year. So I think they're probably looking for a good sounding year as well, or unfortunate they missed out.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is something like an Olympics is such a controversial thing for many cities and countries, right? Because it's a big loss leader. You kind of have to take a medium to long term view on whether you really think that's going to add value. And now you have to hold on and wait off on any sort of like income generation or what you do post that Olympics, where that gives you some sort of socioeconomic driver thereafter. So that I think probably slows all of that down. And I think probably in the 50 to 100 years, it'll be one of those trivia questions. In what year did the Tokyo 2020 Olympics take place? And you're like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
trick question.
Yeah, because they're not actually changing it, right? They're not changing the name. That's the it's still the 2020 Olympics in 2021.
Yeah.
And just throw it into chaos otherwise, right? Because then do you do 4 years from 2021? Or I don't know what the official system behind the 4 years is, but I think probably just easier to pretend it's 2020, because then it's 2024, right? And just keep the system going.
Yeah, and people have won. They're already working on 2024, even 2028. I think they're already working on that. You can't actually change things too much. It's just interesting. Do you have any idea what the budget for the Olympics is? Want to throw out a number?
Spent by the city that's building it, or spent by the organization?
Yeah, so the Olympic Committee's budget. The Olympic Committee's budget.
I'm just gonna chuck out some billions, a couple of billion. Yeah.
So Shooks, you're somewhere in there as well.
I have no idea. So 10 billion.
So 12 billion, and I wrote down 12 billion, and then I went, wait a minute. When you're talking about $1 billion, you don't leave the 0.6, right? So it's 12, because even the 0.6 is a lot. So $12.6 billion is their budget, and because of the shift, the IOC is giving them an extra 800 million. Because can you imagine the people are often employed for the build up and the Olympics. And now it's just like, oh, wait a minute, you're now employed for a whole nother year to keep going on that. So yeah. IOC is giving them $800 million extra. However, they're saying they're going to save $283 million by changing a few things and actually reducing their number of support people that's coming to the country next year. And I'm interested in how, what your thoughts are around that. Is like, what are some of the significant permanent changes that might happen post-COVID on things like this?
I guess it depends if there's a vaccine, if there's any distancing rules, like if are you just going to take that all out and put everyone in stadiums, or are we going to have to start distancing stadiums a bit more? I wonder if there might be some benefits in the current culture of, you know, booking everything, having slots, checking in with your phone, if they might become more systematic in its approach of how it gets people into stadiums, out of stadiums, where they're meant to be. Will it become more of a digital event where you can check in, find your seat, do things more than having support staff walk you around?
Yeah. I'm talking beyond just the pandemic type of thing, but just change in your way of thinking of mass events like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is whether you travel with less people, right? And as you say, like, they're bringing less people in, so do you kind of sweat some of your resources and assets within that particular geographic region in the same way that you would call a taxi cab from the other side of town to come and collect you there? Now you call the closest vehicle to you. And again, I think it's interesting. I think if any country has the sort of resilience to be able to deal with this financially and socially and even emotionally, it would be the Japanese. Because I think for them, it's just kind of like, all right, well, let's just constantly keep improving. You know, this is just what's kind of been thrown our way. And if you speak to people that were involved in the Rugby World Cup last year, in 2019, they said it was like the most amazing experience, you know, where they have like a civilization and like a whole kind of country's history and legacy on showcase in their hospitality. So, it'll be interesting how more resourceful people can be. I think people will invariably be more resourceful about, you know, kind of using the same coaching team or going later or all of those kind of things.
Yep. Yeah, I think it will be. Look, I'm going to shift from here, and I told Ben earlier that it's not linked, but this one is. Another massive event that was meant to be now, and then it's quite weird because it's the Dubai World Expo. It's exactly 1 year from they've pushed it out, and in October 2021, World Expo 2020 will be beginning. So they are 1 year away. And I'm not sure if you know much about it, but it's going to be a six-month event in Dubai. It's going to be absolutely ginormous. It's like 150 countries are going to have exhibition stands. Just some of the numbers we're talking here is that they have already put in 210 million work hours into setting this event up. Just turn comprehend what that is, from a 210 million work hours to build the stadiums, to build the infrastructure, and they will be equipped to transport 46,000 people per hour through the event. That's the kind, and Shukri, you've traveled to Dubai many times, and you actually, didn't you shoot the Dubai tourism commercial? Because I think the just the sheer size of things with Dubai, and the sheer, when they do something, they just do it on such a scale that once again, the whole year postponement, it just impacts everything around it.
You know, the funny thing about Dubai is that they've been expos before, right? I think it was in Milan before this, like 4 years ago, and things like that. And Dubai, as you say, in true Dubai fashion, kind of just wants to do it on a different level. And, you know, you'd kind of be thinking, like, you're crazy if you think Dubai needs another five-star hotel. Because it's kind of just like all over the place. And yet they've really invested so much into it. And I just think about, like, what's next? You know, like, what, like, you know, it's going to be this amazing showcase. It's going to be, you know, it's a 6 month thing, but like, and then like, okay, like how do you sustainably keep these hotels full? You know, like, do you build brick and mortar things that are not going to go off and become housing later and all of those kind of things? So, it's, I don't know. I really don't know what it's going to look like in a few years time.
Yeah, I just quickly calculated the 210 million work hours is also 24,000 years, roughly. I've rounded up there slightly, but if one man was doing the job, it'd take him 24,000 years nonstop. So I imagine they've had a few more workers than that. I think it'll be interesting to see, because I wonder what the impact and the changes you can make when you're running an event over 6 months versus, you know, the Olympics is over a period of time, but it's obviously a lot more condensed. And when you start talking even about live events, like football matches and so forth, like the difference in how these events will change, running one football match in a set 2 hour period versus running an event over 6 months, you can adapt a lot more to it, right, in terms of how you spread things out. I think it will be interesting to see how, what that shift looks like and how it knocks back. I have heard, though, that, you know, some of the areas in the Middle East, like Dubai, are probably going to be the ones that can most quickly bounce back from an economic point of view as well, because there is so much money available there that it won't have to, they'll be able to quickly jumpstart the economy again once they need to, once things start opening back up. So it'll be interesting to see what that looks like, and how they try to get people to these events, and as Shukri said, how they keep the businesses that are getting set up for this and that are going to get to a certain level because of this to sustain that.
I mean, it's like a modern, it's like a modern version of like building the pyramids, right? It's kind of like work hours, and then, like, you know, you can kind of think back and calculate how many hours and how many people it took to build the pyramids and how long they did. And in some ways, this is like some sort of modern iteration of that, in a sense.
Yeah. I'm going to shift a little bit, and I'm going to ask you to bear with me when I'm trying to be a bit creative, right? So listen carefully, because my introduction into the next section, I have a certain number of movie titles in it. You have to guess or figure out how many movie titles I have mentioned when I introduce this next one. Okay?
Okay.
Ready? It may sound a bit like Pulp Fiction. There will be a closure of the Cineworld complexes around the UK, including Notting Hill. In Notting Hill, by the way. And this is because of the crash of the movie industry and the postponement of the James Bond movie, No Time to Die. And it's been postponed a few times. It hasn't been postponed 7 times. It's only been postponed about 3 times. But they will be now releasing the movie in April. And I just don't know if we'll live another day when it comes to the movie industry.
I count at 6.
Yeah? Anyone else?
I was making little lines on my piece of paper, but I only counted 5.
Okay. So I kind of went, yeah, go again.
You got better at hiding it, because at the beginning you were like, Pulp
Fiction. I was fumbling.
And like Notting Hill, and then you were like, yeah. So, and then you kind of hit it a bit better.
So it's Pulp Fiction, the closure. It was the closure of the cinemas. Notting Hill, Crash. Remember the movie Crash of the, and I said the crash of the industry. I mentioned the actual movie No Time to Die. I said 7. It didn't postpone by 7 times, only twice. And then maybe we'll live another day. So there was. I still had planned to put as Rocky Roads and all the rest. But anyway, that's just me trying. Trying to be a bit creative. So, but I wanted to say that, I mean, we're talking about a closure, and I've got the article open in front of me, but it's going to put 5,500 jobs on the line. And the industry, the movie industry itself, has taken a massive knock. And I've often thought about this, and I think Shukri and I have spoken about it, is that marginal businesses will close anyway because of COVID, and then they'll blame COVID, but was their business model itself totally disrupted before that? And do you think that that's what's happened with the movie industry? Do you think that maybe the movie industry was broken anyway, and all that this was a death knell to it?
Is it the movie industry or the cinema industry? Because I think those are two different things, right? So I would say we're probably talking more about the cinema industry. Because, yeah, I remember when younger that, you know, going to the movies all the time, and then just progressively you started noticing that you were paying way more for a movie ticket. And then all of a sudden you're going, God, do I want to go out tonight and spend $15, $20 back home on a movie ticket? It's just so much. So I'll only go and see the blockbusters. And then you no longer would you go and see the little things you might have popped in to see with friends when it was more affordable. So then that, so we obviously started seeing a swing in, you know, indie movies go down. Then you start getting billion-dollar Avengers franchises because they're such an experience you're willing to fork out. And I guess, and then obviously food started becoming, so I think maybe that industry was due a disruption anyway. I recently went to the cinema to see Tenet, so Christopher Nolan, who again is tentpole, you know, he brings it in with the experience of what his movies are now. Just as a bit of a fact, which I learned, to make Tenet, Christopher Nolan was paid $20 million and then also, I think, given 20% of the gross profit just to go and make a movie because his name holds so much weight. So that's just to give you what sort of figures these blockbusters are expected to make. But I paid a little bit more, not much, because it's an independent cinema. They have a bar and a cafe. They have jazz on Wednesday nights in the bar and other things. Not that I necessarily go there, but it all feeds into the experience. But they had a luxury cinema where there was all couches. So it was all by default essentially separated. So they didn't have to change the cinema at all. I just paid a little bit more and had a whole couch with me and my partner. And we had a great time. So I think there's it'll have to figure out how to come out of it. There's probably a way. There's still an experience around going to see it on the big screen. But I think they've probably just hit a lull and something needs to change. And then, yeah, there's probably a good chance to blame it. Or maybe it was just the straw that broke the camel's back to push them over the line, maybe.
I think it's really well articulated in the sense that I think it is the cinema industry that you realize that with like these amazing new models and subscription models that we can watch films and content much more readily. And even with like the improvements in like home entertainment systems and stuff like that all kind of just changes things. And I think live sports has probably suffered the same like kind of feat or like the same kind of thing happened to them in many places. Maybe not in English Premiership football. Because you can still, you know, pack a stadium, but like, you know, you can watch it. It's a great experience, and so I think it is about, and they've tried, as you say, like building like really cool seats and love nests and food and all of these kind of things to create an experience beyond just the film. Whereas in the old days, quote unquote, you know, you had the film. That's all it was, kind of, you know, and that was. You were gonna kind of come no matter what experience it was. So I think it needed to be shifted. I think from a movie industry perspective, Siraj, I think the blockbusters are those outliers. They're gonna make hand over fist money in a blockbuster way. I think in that mid-tier indie sort of space, these subscription model platforms like Netflix and Amazon and stuff like that. Apple, give more people an opportunity to actually get films made, but you don't necessarily make a killing on the back end, right? So even in some of my experience working on some rights issues and things like that with having conversations with Netflix, they're saying, hey, we'll pay you a fee and then we own it. And if people watch it like, you know, 100 times more than we thought, that just is what it is because it's a fixed cost. So it's sort of like you can get it made, but you've got no chance of really becoming a gazillionaire on the back end at that level. So again, it depends what lens you look at it. Like more people are watching films, more people are making films, and how you watch it, and the revenue model has shifted.
Yeah, because Netflix is spending quite a lot of money on some of their blockbusters, right? So some of the movies Extraction, that's like a big blockbuster type movie. But it was only for Netflix. So with Charlize Theron's one or The Six Underground, there were some really big, big budget movies that are going into Netflix. So there is a fundamental shift. And maybe it's also about us getting used to a smaller screen, right? So we all get so used to watching something on our cell phones that maybe watching something on a TV is already bigger. And there's the experience. Do I need to go and sit now with a whole lot of other people in a dark room?
Yeah.
To experience that.
Yeah, I think there is still some value to it. I quite like the switching off that a cinema gives you, literally, yeah. Like, because no one's pulling out their phone. You sit at home and someone whips out their phone to quickly send a text message and then come back to it. And that sort of stuff sometimes bugs me. It's like, just watch it. But then also sometimes I end up doing it if I'm not the one into the movie. So I think there is something still in that experience of going, doing nothing but sitting there and just taking in the cinema. But I think you're right. It'll be interesting to see, though. So on the topic of, like, these platforms making movies just for the platform, there might be other factors into it. But for Disney Plus, for example, they had created Mulan, the live-action version. Mm-hmm. And that kept getting delayed and delayed. And then they eventually just said, fine, we'll put it out on Disney Plus. 60 or 80 million people have subscriptions, whatever, but we'll still charge them for this movie. And it did horribly. It did like 5.9 million in the first weekend or whatever of it being released on a budget of 150 million, which is worse than a bomb in the cinema. Like, bombs in cinemas are 10, 20 million to 100. Like, this is horrible. I don't know if it would depend on the movie itself. There's obviously factors like that, but that was sort of the first person to take an attempt and go, cool, we have this streaming platform, like a Netflix equivalent, but we're going to charge you on top of it. Would you guys pay for a movie on top of your Netflix subscription if they said Extraction 2 is going to cost you £5 to get it, or you can watch it in 6 months?
I probably would pay extra just to see it. I would. And the other thing about these platforms, right, is that they have, and again, from a strategy perspective, they know that they don't need more middle-class Americans or people living in the UK that's kind of saturated. So their growth strategy is linked to the films and the content that they produce. So India is a big growth market. There's certain parts of Africa. And I think what's amazing about that is because you're saying, I'm going to shoot content that you may be interested in, and therefore go ahead and subscribe and get Netflix, right? And that's their acquisition sort of strategy as well as their content. Or their content strategy is part of their acquisition strategy. And I think there's something on like a social level that is, I think, more equal about that, right? So on the one hand, you can create an echo chamber for yourself where you just only the content that you like keeps coming up, a little bit like the social dilemma, kind of that's just what you see. But on the other hand, you are able to not just watch things with that where people have an American accent and it's an American story set in LA, you know, with 90% of the actors being white, you know. So I think it gives us many other opportunities beyond, and I think we have to see it for all of that, you know. And I think with the Netflix films winning Oscars and stuff like that, we're starting to move into that direction where it actually plays a much larger social role, I think.
All right, let's just shift tack. About smart technology, we're going to, in China, some report has shown that the purchase of smart technology has increased. Washing machines that has sterilization as part of it, or hand towels that do the same, smart switches where you can just, you don't have to touch anything. What is your uptake on smart technology? Do you have Alexa? Do you have Siri? What do you guys use? Any of you do that?
I'm an Alexa user. The problem is you can't say it without activating it. I think I got away with it this time. So I can have her turn this light off. I don't know how effective it is with my fake background, which the editors don't love. But I'm Alexa user just in the bedroom at the moment.
Bad, eh, Ben? And it's just like, I'm an Alexa user only in the bedroom. I was like, okay.
Yeah. So I've just got the light and a smart switch in here, which just means while laying in bed, off goes the light without me having to get up. And same in the morning. If it's a dark morning in the UK, once we're in winter and it's still dark till late, I can then set a routine where the light comes on at the time I want to wake up and so forth. So I haven't got a sterilizing towel or washing machine yet. The washing machine makes sense. I guess the towel is just if you come in and the first time you use it. Otherwise, what are you sterilizing if you're already in your own house? I'd like to, and considering then spreading Alexa a little bit further to control more of the lights and so forth.
Shukri, you're a smart tech guy.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I'm a little bit of a germaphobe. So I like the fact that the world has moved to a place where people are like, I've never really loved like the idea of sitting like really close to someone coughing on me. And I've always felt like as I've shaken someone's hand, I'm like super conscious of just being like, oh, I need to wash my hands. Like, so that's always just been me, which I probably need to deal with.
Your inner child kind of sort that out.
Like my mom was actually saying, like, hey, the whole world has to act like you now, you know,
just of how you got an excuse to whip out the hand sanitizer straight after a handshake.
Yeah. I think that's useful. I actually have switched my my Alexa and like Siri and stuff like that off, just because I it goes off all the time, and I'm a little bit more of a purist, you know. I'll switch my own light off.
So here's it kind of that article tied into an article I saw on the BBC where they're asking, because you know, with the advancement of technology, should your accelerator cable on your car stop working when you get to the speed limit? Because breaking the speed limit is illegal, right? So they're saying with the way technology works is you can apply that on certain cars and just go, you will only be able to go the speed limit. You won't be able to go any faster. Are we becoming a nanny state? Are we now going into a state where it's kind of, what can you do if you can't even drive your car as fast as you want? Or is that just breaking the law?
Yeah, I was trying to think of an example of arguing why you would have to go faster than you need to. Because I guess what the only situation I can think of is people like rushing someone to the hospital, right? Imagine if you... I don't know, your pregnant wife's just about to have a baby or something, and you're like, crap, got to get her to the hospital, just sitting there doing 40 in the 40 zone because you're not allowed to go any faster, and that's an empty street, and you're like, yeah.
So didn't that happen to you, Shukri? Didn't your wife nearly give birth in the car?
It was very quick. So no, I would have to have some sort of override switch there, you know what I mean? It's like click and then get going. So yeah, that was actually me.
Because I imagine then you start saying like, all right, well, why don't we not let the car accelerate through a red light? But then if there's a police car behind you, the only way to get out of its way sometimes is to go through the red light and to the side, right? So then I think that starts to get into an area where it's too controlled. And I think people would really fight that sort of level. I think if it's not helping you, people will fight more against it. If it's giving you more convenience, then people will fight it less and just sort of accept it.
You know, it's interesting. When you speak about that, I think there's, I think of two things. The one is, I studied with, when I was at university, with someone who was the CEO of an ambulance service, right? And we were having this debate around robots taking and machines taking over the world. And he genuinely, from a place of real, like having, like on a daily basis, seeing like really horrific things and trying to put systems in place to protect people, was to say that, how can you think that like a driverless car, like, is a bad thing when human beings are just so bad at driving? Like they are reckless and they drive drunk and they speed and they do all of these kind of things. And so I think there is, depending on the lens you look at it, something to say about, you know, like rethinking how technology shapes our life, you know, and not just taking for granted that that's the way it should be. And then I think the speed limit thing for me is again similar to a discussion around capitalism, right? And the type of capitalism that it's kind of like, you know, you've reached that speed, so you should slow down now, or you should become less wealthy. I don't know. For me, that came to mind when you said that. It's like, how dare you tell me I can't drive my car as fast as I want to? It's like, how dare you tell me I can't make any more money? You know? That was something.
Except that your driving fast impacts the people around you. Maybe so does that you make more money.
Yeah.
But
what do you need $2 billion for if you've got one that could be used on social programs and etc.
Oh, Ben, you're so good at helping me segue into my next part. So I'm going to share my screen because I was researching some of the stories last night. And let me share the screen quickly and show you a screenshot of my cell phone. And you can tell me what you think of this. But So can you see my screen now? Yeah. Extreme poverty set for the first time rise since 1998. And the very next point on the BBC says, billionaires' fortunes hit record highs during the pandemic. I mean, that if there's anything that just epitomizes the world at the moment, it's that, isn't it? These two stories that both live on the same news channel, one after the other, where extreme poverty is set to rise, and so is the fortune of billionaires.
I tend to find myself slightly thinking of the counter-argument to a lot of these headlines, because I think they are just meant to immediately anger people to capture the clicks and so forth, and that's the sort of reaction that they're trying to get. So I often think, how are they spinning this in a way that actually it's probably may not be as bad as it is? And I do that with other, you know, media titles as well, not just around the wealthy, but I'd be interested to know if they're just focusing on people like Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and so forth, where their billions are made in businesses that happen to be resilient to this sort of industry. I imagine there's probably people that have lost their billionaire status from COVID and so forth as well. So
would you like to know how many billionaires we have in the world, Ben?
Sure.
Okay, just so you know, in 2017, there were 2,158 billionaires. And this year, we have 2,189 billionaires. So there's actually only been an increase of about 30, which I was surprised about, but I guess that's not the same amount. It's constantly changing. Some guys are dipping under. But yeah, it is interesting that that we've got this mixture. Sorry, yeah. Shukri, you were going to say?
No, for me, we could speak for half an hour just on this, right? In that, like, you there's this Machiavellian, all people are selfish, kind of inherently selfish kind of approach to that, and that you can't just like market-led neoliberal kind of have that approach. And yet, I think there's something to say about the fact that the agency for someone's personal agency to be enterprising and to be inventive and to go out and do things is such an important ingredient of what it means to be a human being and to kind of move us forward and for progression. And I think that too much power concentrated in the structure or the state and the inefficiency of that is also a problem. And so for me, the solution to that is a more human leadership, right? I don't think either of those two extremes work. Like a completely market-led approach where you have no obligation to anyone around you is completely unsustainable. And you will eventually, like speeding on the highway, do damage to other people. And on the other hand, I don't think you can remove people's personal agency to do things and leave that in the structure of an institution or a state to deliver that. So I don't know. I think that is the debate at the moment in terms of where we are as a world.
I'm busy reading a book called Factfulness by Hans Rosling. Factfulness, and it's interesting because what is really the overall the premise of it is to prove that the world is actually a lot better off than it used to be, because we have a tendency to go, oh, back in the good old days. But if you look at it, like, factually, the good old days were not good old days.
You were dying in your 60s in the good old days.
Correct. Yeah. We literally have poverty, abject poverty has dropped tremendously over the last, consistently. You know, that's why there's a nude article to say that it might increase because of COVID right at the back. But generally, there's this big thing. And one of the things that he spoke about in the book also, where we talk, you know, there's this Gini coefficient where as in South Africa, we're one of the highest, it's called Gini coefficient, which is the biggest gap between the rich and the poor. But he's saying that that's actually a myth. There actually isn't a gap. We always talk about this massive gap, but there isn't a gap. It's a bell curve. And yes, you have very rich and you have very poor, but most of the people are somewhere in the middle and most of the people are somewhere in that. And maybe that's one of the things that I've taken out of this. An interesting book, Factfulness, if you want to look into that.
I think you would probably find the same in those titles as well. From you know, you're talking about the first rise, and you're probably right. If you look at the poverty curve, and I don't know this, it's not a fact or anything, but I imagine if it goes down, blip up, there was a global pandemic, you would expect that. And then if we can continue to get it to keep going down, then you're right. From a big picture, it's a blip on the curve. Yes, we need to correct it, but keep positive, like we're working on it, and people will react to it. This has been a very immediate change in the world comparatively, so I think people, it'll take a little bit of time, but people will react, start putting in things in place to help those. But I think you're probably right, because I also hear of a lot of people who lost their jobs and have now started e-commerce jobs, or like, you know, set up new businesses that are going to make them more money. So while the billionaires, and it's probably the people who, you know, own Zoom because their stocks went up so much, and that just generated an extra billion worth of, I think I saw the numbers, and maybe we should look at it next week or something, but it was like in a fortnight, the guy who owns Zoom made 6 billion or something just by his stock increasing. So you can say, yeah, the billionaires are getting billions richer, but it's sort of to be expected. And then I think you're right, the people in the bell curve, there's also a lot of good opportunity coming of this. So it's not just the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. I think there is a middle ground where people there are getting richer, and there's so much more to it.
I think, you know, what you see is the idea of like a fundamental human right. It's only been around for like 100 years, or like, you know, just over 100 years or whatever it is, right? So and that doesn't take away from the hard work that needs to be done, right, in terms of social justice and, you know, the changing kind of social norms in society. But I think what is problematic is when we delude ourselves and put ourselves at a disadvantage because we look at metrics that don't really serve us. Oh, the economy is doing badly, and, you know, this rate there. I was like, you know, actually, again, your ability to go out there and make things happen is going to be far more powerful than what's happening in these macro kind of data and metrics. And I think sometimes people can use it as an excuse for not going out there and actually doing stuff. But again, I stand to be challenged on that as well.
No, it's good. It's good. Guys, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks very much, Shukri. Thank you for joining us. And we were going to have you on, even before Zain had pulled out, but it was good to have you fill his gap. Thanks for being here. And for everyone else, thanks. If you do keep watching, please give us a share, give us a like, tell us what you'd like to see a little bit more of. And if you want to get hold of either Ben or myself, visit centuroglobal.com. And yeah, Shukri, I'm sure you can find him on LinkedIn.
Yeah. All right, thanks so much, everybody.
Cheers, Zain.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Bye.